From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There have been plays and movies with characters who have autism. Rain Man comes to mind, of course. But usually you're seeing it from the outside, from your own perspective. So the behavior can seem strange or disorienting. The playwright Julie Jensen has shifted that perspective for her latest play. It's called Mockingbird, and it's built around Caitlin. She's an 11-year-old girl who falls somewhere in that autism spectrum. She has Asperger's syndrome, actually. So being with a group or experiencing the general commotion of day-to-day life for a student is rendered from her point of view. It's frightening and chaotic. Today in the program, we're talking about Jensen's play as a way to understand how people with autism see and navigate their world. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Utah playwright Julie Jensen's latest play is being workshopped at Weber State University. So she's enlisted a student cast to bring to life these characters that she's drawn to see how the story plays out on stage. It's a piece commissioned by the Kennedy Center in Washington. She was asked to adapt Catherine Erskine's young adult novel Mockingbird. The book is about the aftermath of a shooting at a middle school in Virginia. Two students and a teacher were killed. One of the students was Caitlin's brother, Devin. Caitlin is 11, nearly 12, and she has Asperger's syndrome. And the story is told from her perspective, her point of view, which is a very particular challenge for a playwright and a writer, especially conveying it all on stage. Julie Jensen and Weber State professor Tracy Callahan, who directs the workshop production, have had to recreate the sounds and the movement of day-to-day life, the way Caitlin would see it, would hear it, would experience it. The play gives us a chance to talk about the way people on the autism spectrum experience the world, and so we're talking about it today, and we invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Julie Jensen wrote Mockingbird. Besides her many plays, she's also published a book called Playwriting, Brief and Brilliant, a resident playwright at Salt Lake Acting Company. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Tracy Callahan, I mentioned she's here. She's directing the play, head of Weber State University's acting and directing program. Also going to direct the Kennedy Center performance. And Professor Callahan, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We also have three cast members of Mockingbird here with us. Camry Bagley plays Caitlin. Connor Padilla plays Caitlin's father. Becca Litchfield plays a counselor in her school called Mrs. Brooke. And welcome to you three. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Come back to you guys here in a moment. And have another guest on the program we'll get to in just a moment as well. But Julie Jensen, I wanted to start with you. So you're approached by the Kennedy Center to adapt this young adult novel. Did it seem daunting, exciting? I mean, how did you react?
It's an incredible novel.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. It's a little too episodic for a play. It's got too many climaxes and ends and those kinds of things. So it needed a single structure, but yeah. The scene work was lovely, and the writing is just, it's really amazing. It's an amazing book. So I hope I live up to it.
Was it, did you like the idea? I mean, taking it from Caitlin's perspective, I mean, what was the, did you see it as a challenge? Like, this is going to be hard.
I didn't immediately know how to do it. Hmm. I thought that seeing the world through her eyes was a great way for the theater experience to work.
Yeah.
It's a very theatrical experience, frankly. Yeah. Groups are noisy and scary and chaotic. So that challenge was really very theatrical. I thought, oh, my God, that'll be fun. That'll be interesting.
Yeah.
That'll be beautiful.
Yeah.
I also saw Dog in the Night, which is an adaptation of a novel.
Yeah.
That the National Theater did. And that open the gates even further. Okay. Okay.
It can be done.
It can be done. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Tracy Callahan, you have a child on the autism spectrum.
I do. I have a 22-year-old son, Jacob, who is going to Weber State. It is in zoology. So we really went through, he's high functioning, so we went through a lot of what Caitlin goes through. He's succeeding, but we struggled a lot throughout his life.
So I guess what's interesting to me about that is you must have embraced this opportunity, but it became something, must have been kind of a personal experience for you in some way.
It really was. We were looking for new works. We were doing a season of new works, and I just happened to call Julie and say, what do you have? And she had a couple plays, and one of them was Mockingbird. And that's how we hooked up, and I immediately said, this is something that I would like to lend my creativity to. And my son he read the book, and he's so excited that we're doing this. He's thrilled. He'll be there tonight.
Good. What is the what was the collaboration like for you two? You lending this sensibility that comes from having this experience, but also you have that artistic sensibility too. I mean, what was it like for you two to collaborate?
In a word, great. But I want to explain that an ordinary production is in a professional production is in rehearsal 3.5 to 4.5 weeks.
Yeah.
Sometimes five, but mostly they're turned to 3.5 weeks. That's kind of ordinary and normal. This thing's been in the works for 3.5 months, and it's got movement people. It's got an incredible visual person here who can render stuff. I can write words and make them collide or lay down, but this person can see stuff that I can't. I could never have imagined some of the stuff that's on the stage. It's just amazing, just amazing. So that was exciting beyond my imagination.
How much of that, Tracy Callahan, was, oh, I'm a theater person, this comes naturally to me, I'm visual, all those things, and how much of that was, oh, I'm a mom of a kid who has these kinds of experiences. I think I can relate in that way. Did you have to mix those two gifts?
I did. And, you know, I think the being at the university, you know, we have the capacity. I've worked with some of the students that are here for 4 years, and we have a language. And so we're able to get things done pretty quickly. And I'm a movement-oriented director. And when I saw that there was so much movement in this, it was very exciting. So I was able to cast very young, like freshmen with seniors. You know, of course, we don't have all the age that we should have. But it's been a wonderful collaboration. And I just have loved working with Julie. We've gotten along so well. And we see things, I would say, you know, close to 100% of the time we see things the same way.
So I'm interested in this. Julia mentioned that the group scenes, though. So when someone who has autism, somewhere on the autism spectrum, for the most part, when they're in groups, it can be overwhelming. It can be really scary. It can be chaotic, is I think a word that you've used as well. So what do you have to know about that experience to translate it onto the stage? And how did you do that? Like, so I'm in the audience. What am I seeing that helps me understand what Caitlin is experiencing?
Besides we use a lot of chaotic movement that turn and a lot of stillness versus, you know, pacing changes. We're also using video.
Wait, stillness and pacing. So you've got stillness on one hand, which is dad, right? Is this Caitlin's father? He represents the kind of...
Well, we've got the chaos at school and a more of a stillness at home.
Got it. Okay.
But also the actors go from a chaotic sort of movement to freezing in moments. Mm-hmm. And so just when you think you know where the scene's going to go, it'll switch. Both vocally and physically. We did some recording, some filming. So we have film going on. We have words projected on the stage that she has a huge vocabulary.
Yeah.
And so we have words that will trail over the bodies of the actors. So we have this input, the sensory input coming from all over. And then we have very quiet moments. And so that sort of, that idea of chaos versus stillness is part of, you know, sort of the concept that I think works well with the script.
Because for because for Caitlin, there's all this stuff going on. She's trying to sort of make sense of it because everything is assaulting her senses, mm-hmm. I guess.
And that sensory integration is very, you know, much on works with the kids on the spectrum. A lot of kids have difficulty with, you know, integrating sensory, you know, just things that we take for granted, the buzzing of the lights mm-hmm. or a noise that happens to, you know, across the room. They can hear a tapping of a pencil, and we tune that out. And a lot of times, that's part of the frustration is not being able to tune out, you know, the things that just our brains allow us to do.
Is it I saw it somewhere, something written about the production. I saw the term choreography. Is that apt? Is that right? Is it I'm not sure it's a dance, but it's like choreographing a dance. You're having to get these movements to have a kind of sensibility to them.
Yeah, and I did bring in Sarah Pickett, who I've worked with off and on over the years, and a student from the dance department to come in and watch the choreography and help us with some of the choreography. So, yeah, it's got a language of movement in it.
I'm interested in the contrast then between school and home. Home is less chaotic, of course, for Caitlin. She's in control, right?
Well, home is sad right now because they've lost. There's no mother. Yeah. She died, you know, in the book before the book started, and then they've had this tragedy. So they're dealing with dad's, you know, not being able to cope, and also dad being left alone with her for the first time. The brother was the go-between. Yeah. He was the mediator. He was the one who could handle Caitlin. And now we see dad struggling not only with his own grief, but struggling with raising a daughter for the first time, someone on the spectrum that he doesn't really know as well because he's always had this buffer of this young boy. And Devin was her best friend.
Yeah. Devin, she says in the play, taught her how not to be weird.
Mm-hmm.
So he's helping her negotiate the world.
He has. He's her older brother and has been. He's told her when she's not dressed right, how not to be weird. And that happens. That's how my son is with my other son. He says, that's not funny. You know, that's not a joke. Get off. Don't keep talking about Power Rangers. So it's not the siblings. It's rough for siblings. But it's also there's a really beautiful give and take usually in a family like that. But now he's gone, and so dad struggles. And we see dad grow in learning how to cope as we see Caitlin cope.
Julie Jensen, you talk about this. The setting for the play, you write, is a neutral space. And there's only one constant for Caitlin, and it's this wooden chest. It's this unfinished Eagle project of Caitlin's brother, Devin. And throughout much of the play, it's covered with this gray sheet. Talk about that as an image, and that's the thing that she can sort of – that's the one constant in her life. It's the thing that she sort of comes back to, this image.
Well,
it
represents him, of course, the dead brother. And in my construction of the arc of the play, that chest is – it's not only what Caitlin climbs in and out of and occupies, but what she wants to finish – in order to finish the whole process in way. The book would identify it as closure. I'm not sure about the generalization of that, but they work on it together, she and the dad, and that makes the whole – the arc of the story. It's interesting to deal with a kid on the spectrum as a character in a play because they're not going to change all that much. And that's not what you want to expect. You want to expect that they learn some strategies for coping. Mm-hmm. She learns how to work in a group because she now knows how to work with her dad. You know, things like that.
That's a good segue, actually, into another one of our guests, which is Dr. Sam Goldstein. He's with us, a neuropsychologist here at the University of Utah. Dr. Goldstein developed the autism spectrum rating scales, which is used around the world to identify and treat children. He's got a lot of books, 44 books on autism, among them Raising Resilient Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder, and a children's book, which I want to talk to him about a little bit later, called Billy and the Rock Hounds, illustrated by a Utah teen with ASD, Julia Adams, and Dr. Goldstein, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So I wanted to get you to sort of comment on what we're hearing so far. That first of all, this setting for a play that comes from a young girl's perspective, trying to sort of cope with the sounds from her perspective, the movement from her perspective, the idea that that it's different. What do you make of that, the idea of coming from this perspective, getting that perspective?
Well, it's difficult for any of us to take someone else's perspective. We see through our eyes, but we learn how to take that perspective of others. We call it theory of mind, to understand what you might be thinking. Yeah. And I think Julie does a wonderful job of portraying that, how these children process information, what they hear, what they see, what they touch, what they feel, her concrete nature, her tendency to interpret everything in very rigid ways. And Julie portrays that through her vocabulary use that's wonderful but not functional. And so often these children have lots of information but have a very difficult time integrating that information and making sense of it. And this kind of media really educates the general public about this kind of condition. And I think that's very, very important because that's an important role the arts play in our society, is helping us understand all kinds of phenomena. Sometimes they help, sometimes they hinder. In this case, I think it does a wonderful job of helping.
You know, Julie was mentioning this idea that she's fixed in some way. She has this condition and that's a permanent part of her life for sure, but she's able to adapt. She's able to, through these certain mechanisms, these certain relationships, she does evolve, she does change. Is that an important point?
It's a critical point to understand that biology is not destiny.
Yeah.
It affects probability. This girl is struggling with this, and she slowly begins to assimilate and accommodate these strategies to socialize. And in this very short play, we see all of these aspects, mm-hmm. how she deals with family, how she deals with loss, how she copes with children around her and the strategies she learns, and this wonderful island of competence that she has, this artwork that she slowly harnesses to be part of the group. And that's what made this wonderful connection for me and Julia Adams, whose art is her island of competence, this young woman that I followed for the last 10 years.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. I think that's an intriguing story. So Tracy Callahan, tell us about Mrs. Brooke. She is a counselor at school. Caitlin has to interact with her, gets to interact with her. Talk about that relationship, because I want to have these guys do a scene.
Sure. Mrs. Brooke is where Caitlin is taken when she's disruptive in class. Her teacher, the moment Caitlin acts out in this particular play, the teacher is a little bit lost, throws up her hands and says, well, let's take you to Mrs. Brooke. And Mrs. Brooke is the safe place to land. You know, she's the person who tries to figure things out and help Caitlin survive in the classroom, and especially in this play at Jungle Recess, right? And so she tries very hard. At times she doesn't get it right,
yeah.
But we see her really reaching out, and we see that it is warmth and a really warm place for her to go.
A couple things to point out. One of the things that comes up, Julie Jensen, is this idea from Caitlin's perspective of those who get it and those who don't. What does she mean, those who get it?
Well, she's always trying to get it herself.
Right.
So when other people don't behave in the way that she's been taught that they should, then they aren't getting it either. And so they're all in a big barrel together, not getting it. She has a tough time understanding what things mean, what facial expressions mean, what politeness is and is not, the directness that she never speaks with metaphors. She doesn't understand metaphors. Mm-hmm. So everything is literal. It's a strange way to live in the world, and you don't get a lot of stuff, and she doesn't.
And this idea of hyperspeed. There are moments in the play, I don't think this is actually an example of it, but there are moments where the stage direction is she's in hyperspeed. She just kicks into another way of speaking in some way.
It's a thing I invented. I'm not sure how clinically accurate it is, but that things would rush through your head, and
you have to get it out as fast as you can,
and particularly kind of factual stuff.
Yeah.
That,
All right, well, let's hear a scene, then we can talk to the actors. This is Camry Bagley, who plays Caitlin, and we'll also hear from Becca Litchfield. She plays Mrs. Brooke.
Well, hello, Caitlin. You're early.
I told Mrs. Johnson that, but she said it was the right time. She is having trouble getting it today.
Well, let's talk about that.
She wants us to work in groups, but I do not want to work in a group.
Caitlin, can you remember to look at the person? When a teacher says she wants you to do something, that means you should do it. It's the same as saying you must do it.
Then why didn't she say that?
It's a nice way of saying it.
It's not a nice way of saying it. It's a confusing way of saying it. And she should say please if she's trying to be nice.
Would that have helped, if she had said please?
I don't know.
Maybe I'll have a talk with Mrs. Johnson and we can sort this out. But in the meantime, can you tell me why you don't want to do a group project with some of the girls?
I can do a better group project by myself.
I'm sure you can do a wonderful project by yourself, but there's also value in working in a group.
What is the value?
Making friends.
I already have friends.
Tell me about your friends.
Dictionary, TV, computer, purple fleece.
I'm talking about people and learning how to get along with others.
I know how to get along with others. I leave them alone.
That's not the way, Caitlin.
It's what they tell me to do. Leave me alone, Caitlin. Caitlin, go away. So I am listening. I am doing what they say, and I am being nice.
It can be difficult to make friends, but I'm going to help you. Let's think about the children in your class. Are you thinking?
Already did.
Who did you think of?
Josh.
Oh, do you like Josh?
No.
Let's try to pick someone you like, and we'll work on a friendship with that person. Whom do you like?
I don't know.
Think hard.
Miss Harper.
Miss Harper?
Yes. She is the principal. Get it? She's everyone's pal.
Yes. Okay. But I'm thinking of someone your age.
Who were you thinking of?
I'd like you to think of someone.
I give up, so why don't you just tell me?
Well, how about Emma?
Emma?
Yes, she's very outgoing.
I do not care for very outgoing, or effusive, or extroverted, or gregarious, or any of those words that mean their loudness fills up my ears and their waving arms invade my personal space.
It's easier to talk with people who are outgoing, don't you think?
This is what I think. I think you do not get it.
You're a very special person, Caitlin. You'll make a wonderful friend. Let's look up the word friend in your dictionary. It says, somebody emotionally close.
Emotions. I do not care for emotions.
Why is that?
Emotions are not one of my strengths.
There's a scene from the play Mockingbird. It's Julie Jensen's latest. So, you notice there, I only saw one incident in there of Caitlin using a contraction. She's very precise.
Very. I wrote an early draft in which there was not any contraction.
Yeah, yeah.
There were none. But we modified that slightly. But I wanted it a little stilted and mm-hmm. a little overly corrected or overly precise, and it was a way to get at that.
You know, it's interesting. Dr. Goldstein, talk a little bit about the joke she tells. Which is kind of clumsy and a little goofy and not entirely funny, but at least she's making an attempt.
She makes an attempt, and what you notice is the pitch, the prosody of her speech, the pitch, rhythm, and tone is off. The timing of her speech is off, sometimes a little robotic, and she's very rigid in how she portrays language, and she tells a joke. We had a research project years ago. We were trying to teach children with autism how to take other people's perspective, and I'd go in the group and tell one of my best jokes, and they didn't laugh. And then one of them would tell a joke, and they all laughed. I didn't think it was funny.
Wow.
And so this idea...
Wait, so what was the difference?
I never figured it out. Huh. We also were not able to really teach that theory of mind other than the way Caitlin gets
right.
it, in a very rote way. So she learns a rule and then has a hard time generalizing that rule and why emotions are such a problem, and listeners can't see the actor's face, but she does a very good job. And in thermography research, we find that children with autism don't innervate the muscles of their face as well. They're much stiffer in how they respond. And the actor here, or the actress, does a wonderful job in portraying that.
Camry, talk about that. How difficult was it to construct this role for you?
It's been quite the challenge because I didn't know a lot about autism when I first auditioned for it.
Yeah.
So a lot of what I've done through the process, I've worked a lot with Tracy. You know, she's helped me quite a bit. But then I've also read a lot of documentaries and tried to watch, you know, interviews with people with autism. And, like, I focused, like, Temple Grandin,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Of course. Yeah.
She was a good resource for me to go to just kind of notice some of their physicality and some of the ways they react to others.
Dr. Goldstein used the word robotic, and mm-hmm. It's almost robotic the way you're reading. Do you think about it in that way, and do you have to kind of freeze parts of your face or your delivery in some way?
I guess so. I mean, I think it's just knowing that they don't process emotion the same way other people do.
Yeah.
So they don't know how to show it on their face. Like, there's a scene in the Temple Grandin documentary where they're showing her pictures, and she says, you know, show me the picture of where you're happy. And she can't point to the picture of where her face looks happy.
Wow.
And to me, that's interesting that they don't know how to show emotions in the appropriate way.
Tracy Callahan, what was your relationship with Camry like? I mean, what were you talking to her about? What's the relationship like? Was it a typical director-actor relationship, or was it different, special in some way?
I think it's typical in the sense that, you know, this is what I do, and I usually ask actors to go to some sort of extreme because that's the kind of show I usually do. But we did talk a lot about physicality. We talked about that stiffness. We talked about mind blindness, or there's probably mind theory. And then I did talk to her quite a bit about my own son, and you know, just kind of silly things that happened. I wanted this show to have light moments because there's somebody that we're dealing with death. We're dealing with a child that has, you know, really struggles. And so we wanted to find lightness in it too. And so we were always kind of working through finding that sense of humor and finding how she copes in the world. Because sometimes people say horrible things to her and it bounces right off her. She doesn't see it as an insult like maybe you or I would. Because she's just like, okay, they say they don't like me, so I stay away from them. She learns.
It's logical.
Okay, they don't want me, I'm not there. So yeah, but we worked a lot physically. And there was just one day we had a breakthrough, I feel. We just were alone together. I think we let everybody else go, and she and I just kind of took her to the limit and physically and let her explore that. And that was a breakthrough moment, I believe. Do you, Camry?
Definitely.
Okay. What was it?
It was just not being able to go far enough with the she goes home and she throws these tantrums, TRMs, tantrum rage meltdown, and I think it was difficult for her to let go, just to be able to all the frustrations that built up, because the kids at school, and this was true with my son, all day long they'd have to stop their tics and stop this so that they were considered okay, so they'd be holding it in,
and then finally, when they get home
they can let it go, and I think that was a little bit difficult for Camry to just want to just let go. But there are several scenes. She gets in the box.
Yeah.
She tries to bring her brother back. So we did have a breakthrough moment. And then ever since that point, about halfway through rehearsal, I think things started to really go in a fantastic direction.
Is that how it worked?
Yes, definitely. I think it was hard originally because I was trying to focus on Caitlin's structure that she puts on herself.
Yeah.
And so it was hard, you know, to try to see Caitlin as losing control.
Right.
And so I think that was definitely a good breakthrough moment.
That's Camry Bagley. She plays 11-year-old Caitlin in Julie Jensen's play Mockingbird. We have Tracy Callahan with us. She directs the play. She's head of Weber State University's acting and directing program. We have Dr. Sam Goldstein with us, too, a neuropsychologist here at the University of Utah. And we have Connor Padilla, Becca Litchfield, also with us here. We'll hear a little bit more from them when we get back from a break. Let me mention the play is, we'll get some details for you when we get back from a break. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. The is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about another play. We were talking about one yesterday. This one is designed to give you a sense of what autism is like through the eyes of a child. Our guide is a character, 11-year-old Caitlin, at the center of Utah playwright Julie Jensen's latest called Mockingbird. She built the play out of Caitlin's perspective, her point of view, and we're talking about that today. Mockingbird opens tonight at Weber State University's Browning Center for the Performing Arts. It runs through April 5th. They're workshopping it for the Kennedy Center. Julie Jensen is with us. We have the director of the play, Weber State University's acting and directing chair, Tracy Callahan, with us. We have the actress Camry Bagley, who plays Caitlin. We have Connor Padilla, who plays Caitlin's father. Becca Litchfield plays Mrs. Brooke in the play. And we have with us also Dr. Sam Goldstein, who's a neuropsychologist here at the University of Utah. He's authored a number of books, among them a children's book called Billy and the Rock Hounds. And you can join us, by the way, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Got a comment from Terry from Ogden who writes, I'm on this spectrum. Unfortunately, one of the biggest challenges that people don't like you because they don't understand you. I mean, exactly what I say, but they understand it differently. At best, he said, you annoy people and that builds up and it finally reaches a point that they don't want to be around you anymore and they don't know why. I've lost jobs because of this, Terry writes. It makes it really hard to accomplish things. Tracy Callahan, you relate to that, I suppose?
Really do relate to it. I mean, I think initially, you know, some people don't walk in the room and you know they have autism, especially high functioning people. And so what tends to happen is you have conversations. You'll maybe have a play date, or you'll get a job. And then as time goes on, some of the more, I guess I'll say, peculiar or different aspects of not being able to relate come out. And I think it is difficult to maintain long-term relationships for people. And I found that with my son, and I think that's one of the most difficult aspects of the spectrum of the disorder.
I'm sure you get that kind of comment from Terry all the time. They don't understand.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that as a species, we're hardwired to connect. Yeah. Infants, that's how they survive, is immediately connecting to you, making eye contact, developing a social smile. And the most visited sites on the web are baby kittens and baby puppies. We love babies. We are hardwired to attach. And so this kind of a problem, unlike other childhood problems, a learning disability or depression or anxiety, this impacts a child from the very beginning, right out of the gate. And the emerging research suggests that the earlier we can expose children to an enriched social environment, the more likely it is that their brains adapt and evolve in such a way that they connect. We're having great success now, but it takes lots of time. These are preschool programs that are every day for multiple years, and you slowly begin to see what happens. And what happens with Caitlin is it's like paint drying from the outside in. She develops these outward social skills, but inward she's still asking herself, why are they doing this? Why am I doing this? Yeah. What's really going on here? But she has enough road ability to get by each day. And that's what happens to this gentleman who calls in. His paint is almost dry, but he still doesn't always get it. And he knows what to do, but he doesn't always do what he knows. And same for Caitlin.
Huh. Caitlin has this quote-unquote group project. She doesn't like being in the groups, but she's got this project. It's on the human heart and how it works. And let's explain, her brother Devin has been killed in this school shooting. And she has this sketchbook that shows really very clinical pictures that she's drawn of a human heart and a very graphic portrayal of this heart of Devin, her brother. She shows it to her father, obviously has a difficult time taking it in. Talk about that, because in some way it seems incredibly insensitive. She's showing this, you know, blown apart heart of her brother.
Insensitive. What does that mean to her?
Yeah.
She doesn't know that. She's preoccupied by the death of her brother. And she says to a little friend of hers that she meets in the schoolyard that his mother had been shot. And they talk about, and their blood came out and their hearts. And they're just talking about it. That's all they do. I mean, just to say it.
Yeah.
We get a bunch of emotional stuff that goes with that, and they have to say it correctly, and don't... She doesn't have any of those skills, and she's preoccupied by the fact that he died, and his heart was shot. Mm-hmm. And so she wants to take a look at that, and she wants to draw a picture of it. And that, of course, sets off her father.
I want to have you do another scene, because there's an interesting thing that's going on in this scene, and there's another conversation. It begins with this conversation. Caitlin and Mrs. Brooke, again, are talking. And then we shift, as you'll hear, to her father. And you get a sense, and Tracy Callahan, let's talk a little bit about this. Dad, Connor Padilla's character, he's having a rough time, and she's saying these things that, again, seem insensitive to him, mm-hmm. and he's trying to negotiate all of this. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about Dad as the character.
Well, as I said before, I don't think he has been the major caregiver for her, yeah. and so he's left, you know, to deal with her for the first time without the teenage brother, the young brother being the buffer. But he is trying, you know, he tends to shut her down at times. I mean, he'll go off into the shower and cry, and she'll hear him. And he's sad. I mean, he doesn't have a place to mourn. And she's there being very literal in his face, trying very hard to reach him. But they are like on two different planets. They are just not able to help each other out at the beginning of the play, at least.
Here's another scene from the play, Mockingbird.
Now, what's this?
What's what?
You're having trouble with Mrs. Johnson.
No, Brianna. I was being a friend to Brianna.
I know you were.
She fell off her bike.
And you moved her desk to the corner.
Yes.
I know that you might feel comforted sitting in the corner so people can't look at you, but Brianna doesn't.
Why not?
It felt to her as if you wanted to get rid of her by putting her in a corner.
That is not what I meant.
I know, but try to put yourself in her shoes.
Huh?
Try to understand her point of view. That's empathy, when you walk in someone else's shoes.
What does it have to do with shoes?
When you feel what someone else feels.
But why shoes?
It's another way of saying empathy.
I'm not sure I can do other shoes or empathy.
Of course you can. You know, Caitlin, your father is concerned about you.
Meaning what?
Meaning that he's worried about an aspect of your behavior.
Why?
He thinks you do not understand that your brother is gone.
He is not gone. He is dead.
But your father says you refer to Devon as if he were alive.
That is because he seems alive, like he could come through that door. But I know he is dead.
Perhaps when you speak of Devon, you could use the past tense, because your dad is worried.
I do not understand how that will help anything.
Why don't you try it?
By walking in Dad's shoes?
In a way, yes.
In a way, yes. In a way, yes. In a way, yes. When I get home, I remember what Mrs. Brooke said, and I have a plan to make everything okay. Devon, who is dead, once said to me, "You would die if you did not draw every day." And I said back to Devon, who is dead, "I will never die because I draw every day." And now I am going to draw a picture of Devon, who is dead. Up in this corner will be the eyes of Devon, who is dead. Over here will be the nose of Devon, who is dead. In this corner, the mouth of Devon, who is dead. And down here is the hair of Devon, who is dead.
What are you saying, Caitlin?
I am calling him by name.
His name is Devon.
No, his name was Devon. Now it is Devon, who is dead. That other Devon was alive, but now he is dead, and that is why I am calling him Devon, who is dead, and you will get used to it.
No, I won't. I'll feel upset every time you say it.
Even if I say it 50 times?
Yes.
Even 100 times?
Yes.
Even 1,000 times?
Caitlin! I get upset even thinking about it.
I am only saying it because you are wondering if I think Devon is alive. So I am showing you, I get it, that Devon is dead.
Just, let's not talk about it, all right? Let's both just shut up.
I stare at the chest of Devon, who is dead, and wish for the millionth time that Devon was here. Because even when I try to get it, I still do not get it.
Dr. Sam Goldstein, what are you seeing in that scene? It's interesting, this moment, and Julie, I want to hear from you, obviously, on this, when Caitlin says he's not gone, he is dead. What's the kind of distinction that she's making? What is she not getting?
Well, again, it's the rigidity and the utter rationality. I mean, the late Gene Roddenberry's character in Star Trek, Mr. Spock, was his portrayal of someone who is completely left-brained, rational, yeah. No emotion whatsoever. And we're a species that evolved based first on our emotions. We process the world emotionally. We've created this other part of us. And so for her, she doesn't see him as a single entity. She sees him in a certain time and place. Mm. And she referred to him as Devon. And then she was told, well, but he's not here anymore. Yeah. And to resolve that, she creates another Devon. That's the old Devon. This is the new Devon. Again, it is a reflection of this extreme rationality. And she struggles to make sense of the world. And we don't get it because we don't see it that way. And so she upsets her father when, in fact, as she said as she came home from school, she thought she had a plan to make everything better. And what happens to a lot of the children I see who struggle with this is that they think, well, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
And then they're knocked down again and again and again. And eventually it affects your sense of stress hardiness and resilience.
Yeah, because it guts him. So, Connor, was this a tough part?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was. I'm not a parent. And so it was difficult for me to kind of wrap my brain around this this idea that his wife is dead. He's lost a child in a school shooting, and this in and of itself is a tragic story. But then to have a child, a special needs child on top of it, to be left alone with her and have to take care of her and deal with his own grief and care for this child, it was kind of a daunting task.
Dr. Goldstein, you were saying off air something that you found kind of interesting was the fact that the main character who has, was on the spectrum is a girl, not a boy.
Right. And depending on how you define this problem, rather than call it a diagnosis, let's just call it an ability,
yeah.
The ability to learn social skills and interact. And it appears that this kind of a challenge is much more prevalent in boys than girls. And the fact of the matter is girls do a lot of things better than us, particularly dealing with emotions. And so for this character, it's even harder for the counselor and the teachers and her family to understand her. If the character was a boy, we would tend to be a little more accepting of, well, this boy is this way. But when it's a female, I think in society, it's even harder to accept and understand.
Julie Jensen, when you hear the play read, see it acted, does that make you... I don't want to use the word proud, but do you figure, hey, I may have gotten that right?
As a playwright, you always think, well, this is in my head, and this is the way it looks, and this is the way it ought to sound,
yeah.
Right? So you have it going on as you're writing it. And I always say the best experiences with the productions are those where the reality of the production is so much better than what you could have imagined. And this is one of them. It's just, I couldn't have done it. It couldn't get there in my head.
And let's say something about the acting. I mean, student actors, they've done a terrific job.
Terrific. Terrific. People keep asking me, well, have they gotten it? I mean, really? They're amazing. And they are astonishing actors. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Good job, you guys. Julie Jensen is with us. We have with us Tracy Callahan as well, directs the play, Camry Bagley, Connor Padilla, Becca Litchfield. Dr. Sam Goldstein is also with us. He is the author of a number of books, among them a children's book called Billy and the Rockhounds, illustrated by Utah Teen with ASD, Julia Adams. And Mockingbird opens tonight at Weber State University's Browning Center for the Performing Arts, runs through April 5th. For tickets and more information, you can call 801-626-8500 or just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break, come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are profiling Julie Jensen's latest play, Mockingbird. It is being produced, workshopped at Weber State University. She's doing it, was commissioned by the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. It's going to have its premiere next year. But you can see it early at Weber State, as I said. It's directed by Tracy Callahan. Really good cast. Camry Bagley is in it, along with Connor Padilla, Becca Litchfield. They're here with us today. We have Dr. Sam Goldstein with us here as well. And I want to get to another scene here quickly. Julie Jensen set this up for us. It's this chest is a – it's the one constant, of course. It's this chest that her brother Devin was working on for his Eagle project, didn't get a chance to finish it. It's not finished, but this idea of finishing it becomes really important to Caitlin. Talk about that.
It's a way she has of keeping in touch with him, and that the two of them have of keeping in touch with each other. So it becomes the metaphor for that in a world where, of course, Caitlin doesn't understand metaphors, but literally she wants this fixed. And, of course, Dad's response to things is, leave it the way it was. Yeah. That's the way he left it, and I don't want to touch it. So their collision over that.
And we should point out also that I just want to make it clear, she gets in the chest itself in the scene. Here it is, another scene from Mockingbird.
The rest of the stupid reading buddy's time is a blur. I read really loud so that Michael can hear me reading to him, even though I am at the other end of the room. Then the stupid little girl I am reading to starts crying because she says I am yelling at her, which I am not. And then Michael is sitting by Josh, and Josh is giving Michael a high five, and Michael and Josh are giggling. That's when Mrs. Brooke takes me out of the room early. Devin said, if you want to be a scout, you have to work at it. I know he was talking about Boy Scouts and Eagle Scouts, but he also said that about anything I had to do. You have to work at it, scout. That's what he said. I know, I told him, because he said it a lot, a lot, a lot. And sometimes I do not want to hear the same thing over and over and over. Especially if it is hard. And working at it is very hard. Sometimes I do not want to work at it anymore. Like when I finally get my own friend, then Mrs. Brooke takes him away from me. It is just too hard and it is not fair.
Caitlin? Caitlin! Are you in here?
I'm in the chest.
What are you doing in there?
Thinking.
Thinking about what?
Thinking I'm going to stay here and make this my chest now.
Why is it your chest?
It was always supposed to be mine. I asked Devin if I could have it.
When Devin had gone to college.
Well, he is gone.
But he's not just gone to college. He's gone.
I already asked him, can I have your chest when you die? And he said yes.
Caitlin, I think you know you're not supposed to talk like that.
No, I don't.
Well, you cannot have the chest. It's Devin's chest. It's one way we remember him.
Then why don't we finish sanding it?
Because we're leaving it the way it was when he left.
And why don't you say dead? You say those other words instead, like gone and left. You should say the true word. The true word is dead.
Please be quiet now, Caitlin. Please.
Devin's chest. Not my chest. Devin's chest. Not my chest. Devin's chest. Not my chest.
That's enough, Caitlin.
Devin's chest is still not done, and I guess it never will be.
And get out of there, please.
Get out of where?
Get out of that chest.
If I get out now, can I get back in for supper?
Not now, not ever again.
But why?
Because I don't want you in there.
What about what I want?
You heard me, Caitlin. Out, now.
It's not your chest, it's Devin's chest.
And I will not have you talking back, sassing me.
It's as much my chest as it is yours.
Caitlin, what are you doing?
I want to finish the chest.
You have no right to touch that chest. That's Devin's chest. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever.
Think about what Devin would say. He would say, you have to work at it, Dad.
I just don't know what anything means anymore.
Devin would say you have to try, even if it is hard and you think you can never do it, and you just want to scream and hide and shake your hands over and over and over. That's what he would say.
How did you get so smart?
I really work at it.
from the play Mockingbird. Dr. Sam Goldstein, we're running out of time here, but I think that that last moment where Dad is learning from Caitlin is an important moment. I mean, he's that interplay. It's not just us teaching the kids. It's the kids. It's us learning from them, too. That's an important part, it seems.
Well, and sometimes rationality is an important force to temper our emotions. And so there is something to learn from this. I mean, what Caitlin demonstrates is too much of a good thing. She's too rational. But there are times when our emotions, again, we process the world emotionally before we do with the front of our brains. And there are times when taking a pause, opening a window between experience and response, and thinking about an experience that's being so driven emotionally in a rational way is important. And so it is a valuable lesson, and it's an opportunity at that moment for her to use her rationality to temper her father's emotions and guide him into something that puts some closure on their grief and on their mourning.
We're essentially out of time. Tracy Galland, what are you expecting from in terms of reaction? The people, how are people reacting so far? I know have you had an audience yet?
No, we haven't. But I think we have these scenes with children, and the actors are doing such a great job of portraying the children that I think when young people, 10 and up, I guess we're saying, come to see it, there is a real connection with the group of kids. And I think Julie's done a wonderful job of finding the light and the dark in Caitlin's life, and I think that's really important.
That's Tracy Callahan. She is the director of Mockingbird. She's head of Weber State University's acting and directing program. Julie Jensen, of course, playwright. She has a book called Playwriting, Brief and Brilliant, resident playwright at Salt Lake Acting Company. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Doug.
Thanks to the actors, Camry Bagley, Connor Padilla, Becca Litchfield. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Break legs tonight. Good luck to you. Dr. Sam Goldstein with us as well, the author of a number of books, among them a children's book called Billy and the Rockhounds. Dr. Goldstein, thanks to you.
Thanks. And can I mention the book's now available at King's English Bookstore?
Brilliant. I want to have you back to actually talk about the book a little bit more because we'll continue this conversation. Mockingbird opens tonight at Weber State University's Browning Center for the Performing Arts, runs through April 5th. For tickets and more information, go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.